UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on BeThinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
It's all a matter of interpretation. You know, theologians disagree about the Bible. Language has no fixed meaning. Roland Barthes puts it like this: literature, by refusing to assign a secret and ultimate meaning to the text and to the world as text, liberates what may be called an anti-theological activity, an activity that is truly revolutionary, since to refuse to fix meaning is, in the end, to refuse God. Do you see what this guy's saying? He's saying that to say language has no meaning is predicated on the idea that there is no God. Those two ideas have come very closely together. Nietzsche said this: we cannot get rid of God until we get rid of grammar. We cannot get rid of God until we get rid of grammar. So this idea that somehow we don't have to make a response to the Bible, we don't have to take it seriously because, you know, it's all a matter of interpretation, people say different things about the text, we can't be sure about what it means, words have no actual meaning or content, is part of a bigger movement which says language is ultimately meaningless because there is no God. Now, this whole concept came home to my husband and I in quite a strange way about 2 years ago. My husband is a pastor, which means that he can conduct weddings. In Britain, that means you're allowed to do weddings. And many of his old school friends are not Christians. And so when they want to get married, they invite him as the only vicar, the only pastor they know, to come and do their wedding. And there was a couple who were getting married who were from a very wealthy background, and my husband had been invited to do the wedding. And during the service, he gave a sermon. And in the sermon, he really preached the gospel with great passion. And lots of these rich, upper-class English people were sitting there rather stunned by this young, fiery vicar who was preaching to them. But at the end of the service, and they loved it, they really loved what they heard. But at the end of the service, we went for the wedding party. And we were sitting around these circular tables. And there was a couple who were sitting with us. And I was talking to the man, and my husband was talking to the woman. As I was talking to the man, after about 5 minutes into the conversation, he stopped and said, "You know, I just have to stop for a moment, because I find that I can't lie to you." He said, "I have been lying for all of this conversation since I met you." And I sort of looked rather questioningly at him. And he said, "Before my girlfriend and I came to this wedding, we decided to swap lives. She is pretending to do my job, and I am pretending to do her job. And we thought we would just see if people reacted differently to us on the basis of our job." And I said, "Well, that's very strange." And he said, "Yes, it is strange, but why can't I lie to you? That's strange." So we began to talk about the Holy Spirit and what it means for God to live in a person. And as we were talking, we looked over at my husband and his girlfriend, and he said to me, "I wonder if my girlfriend has managed to deceive your husband." And I was thinking, "Lord Jesus, let Frog be listening, let him be aware," you know, just praying inside my heart. Well, do you know, exactly the same thing happens with her. And she had been very moved by the talk.
Dog.
And she said, "I want to ask you some questions about the Bible." So my husband said, "Fine, I'm a vicar, I will try to answer them." She said, "I do not believe that I can become a Christian because I do not believe that words have any meaning." And he sort of smiled and let her carry on. And she said, in fact, I have been studying languages at Edinburgh University. And I know, because of Derrida's writings, that there is no transcendental signifier. That means there is no God who is above our reality to give words meaning. So she said, when my Christian friend gave me a Bible, I started to read John's Gospel. And as I was reading it, I was very drawn to Jesus Christ. But she said, then I remembered, it is impossible for me to learn anything from a text because words have no meaning. They only have the meaning that I, in my mind, already have and give to that word. Interesting. So my husband sort of carried on nodding, and she carried on a little bit longer talking about how that was why she couldn't become a Christian. And he just simply said to her, that's interesting you say words don't have any fixed meaning. Are you saying that words only have the meaning that the hearer, the listener, or the reader gives them? She said, that's exactly it. Words on the page only have the meaning that's already in my mind I give to them. So my husband said, well, I'm the listener here, aren't I? She said, yeah. So he said, is it okay if I take what you have just said to mean, I am a Christian, I believe in Jesus, and I'm going to heaven? Because I'm the hearer, I'm the listener, so I determine the meaning. And her face kind of fell. And she thought for a few moments, and they began to talk further on. That was interesting. At the end of that conversation, he was able to pray with her. This was the real issue for her. Where has this idea come from? We need to look quickly. I just want to look at a few motifs which have influenced people to believe this, that it's all about interpretation. The first one is the idea that language is a game. Now, the philosopher Wittgenstein is really the kind of author of this idea. And he said that language occurs within separate systems which have their own rules. And so one particular language game and another language game have very little to do with one another. And that means that no proposition or sentence can have a single meaning. Its meaning is totally dependent on the context in which it comes. So when we come to the Bible, that means, you know, I, as an English person, aged 28, open my Bible and I read it and it has a particular meaning to me. But, you know, a black person in Africa would open the Bible and it would have a different meaning to them. Or an older person or anybody else. Language is just a game. And the rules of the game only apply within the game. Okay, the second kind of way that this is sometimes articulated is the kind of rejection of a meta-narrative. That means that there are no overarching myths or stories which give a framework of meaning to language. So there is no unifying idea. French thinker Lyotard talks about fighting a war on totality. He's trying to fight against any idea of universal meaning. So any worldview or framework can be rubbished and is only legitimate within itself. It has no legitimacy beyond its own borders. Okay, then thirdly, we come on to what I talked about a tiny bit earlier, the idea of language as power. So Foucault says that because there are no firm foundations for knowledge or for language, there's no transcendental signifier, there's no God who is outside of our reality who gives language meaning. Any attempt to give that language a fixed meaning is an attempt to take power over somebody else's life. He said this, power produces knowledge. There is no power relation without the correlative constitution of the field of knowledge, nor any knowledge that does not presuppose and constitute at the same time power relations. Have you ever thought about why people get so hot under the collar and so kind of cross when you begin to talk about truth, when you begin to talk about real meaning revealed in Jesus Christ that has meaning for everyone. Part of it is a reaction to this. Christians are typecast as the ones who are trying to impose and take power over your life as an individual. Okay, then fourthly, we have language and meaning. So Derrida kind of approaches it in a different way, and I think this is really interesting as a Christian. The language that he uses is incredible. He attacks the idea of what he calls logocentrism, saying again that language has any fixed meaning that is connected to reality. He's saying we must deny the idea of a God. We must deny the idea of this ultimate reality, a presence which undergirds reality and language. And once we've denied that, then we can go down this postmodern route. But any searching for a word or presence or truth or reality is a search for God and must be denied because it doesn't exist. But interestingly, he says, if there were such a thing, if there were a logos, if there were such a reality, then language would have meaning. So it's very interesting, and he plays around with the whole idea of then the logos taking flesh and coming and dwelling amongst us. It's almost a Christian apologetic if you kind of look at it from the opposite angle. Okay, so we have this fundamental attack on language. So how do we as Christians deal with this when it comes to the Bible? If we attempt to say, you know, language can have meaning and we show the bankruptness of these ideas, because after all, Derrida, Foucault, all of these thinkers are using language and are expecting us to take what they mean. They're accepting their own statements from their rules. If we show that inherent inconsistency, if we show that this doesn't work at all, that silence, as Bill Craig said last night, is the only option, how then can we present the text of the Bible to our friends, to our skeptical friends? Well, I think that the starting place probably does need to be the Gospels, as those are talking about the life of Jesus and, you know, a good place to start. But in terms of scrutinizing the text as a non-Christian, as a skeptic, the first question I would want to encourage someone to ask is, what is the intention of the author? What is the intention of the author? If it is possible for meaning to occur, if there is a transcendental signified, and texts and words can carry meaning, when we come to the Bible, what are the author's intentions? Is this conveying truth to me? Now, the gospel writers really help us along with this because both Luke and John are explicit about their intentions, and we can open this up to our friends. Luke, a Gentile doctor, a scientist who went about and researched for his gospel, expresses his intentions at the beginning of his writing. He says this: many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things that you've been taught. So Luke is telling us, I am a Gentile, I am a doctor, I am not a Jew who saw Jesus personally in action. I am not an eyewitness. But I have gone and researched all of these things so that people like me, who also didn't see Jesus, or whose aunt, uncle, brother, sister weren't in the crowd when certain things happened, I'm writing my gospel so that they, like me, can know what happened. And I'm trying to be trustworthy. I'm looking into things. I'm scrutinizing the evidence, and that's my motivation. So he tells us about his intention. What about John? He tells us his intention. In contrast to Luke, John was the beloved disciple. He was the one who laid his head on Jesus' breast. He was exceptionally close to Jesus, and he tells us his intentions in John 20, verse 30. He says this: Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, and that by believing, you might have life in his name. So we can take our skeptic, who hopefully has been moved from the point of saying language can have no inherent meaning, we can take them and ask them to examine the text of the Gospels. And we can say to them, scrutinize these texts. Think about the intentions of the author. Luke is very open about his intention. John is very open about his. Now go away and read it. Now, I'm not trying to suggest that because the authors give us their intentions, an unbeliever, a skeptical person, should just automatically take those gospels on as gospel truth, should take them at face value. Not at all. But once we've been told the motive of the author, we can then scrutinize those motives for ourselves, and there are a number of possibilities. Oh, I don't know what's happening here. Sorry. That's my virus software, I think. Okay, so what are the possibilities? Okay, the possibilities are, to my mind, broadly three. The first one is this. Is it possible that the author has genuine motives? Okay, so Luke and John, you know, John is genuine. He loves Jesus. He wants us to have life in his name. But John has been deceived. Okay, so he's sincere in his motivation. He's an authentic person, an individual who is, you know, a good person. But he has been deceived. So what he is passing on to us is false. The second possibility is that the author knows that the information they're writing down is false, and they are intentionally trying to deceive us. So John knows that Jesus isn't the Christ. Luke knows that what he's writing didn't really happen. He's researched it, he's looked into it, but he's changed it. He's making it up to deceive me and to deceive you. That's a possibility. And then the third broad possibility is that the author has genuine motives. They believe that what they're writing is true. And that by and large, they are recording what actually happened. Okay, so we have these three kind of possible intentions. Three kind of possible broad things. And they may well overlap, but we can only discover that by reading. So how do we go about deciding which one of these three is the case? Remember, we're dealing with a skeptic here. We're not asking someone to go straight to number three just because we say so. We want them to consider the first two. So how do they do that? Well, I would want to suggest that they approach it inductively and deductively. So they can ask questions like this. Does the text of the gospel make sense of the world which is external to it? Okay, so does the content of the gospels that they're reading make sense of the world that is external to that text? So can the reader, can you or I, make connections between what is in the text and the real world around us? Or is this gospel merely a circle of its own reality that you have to blindly step into? Do you see, does it connect with reality outside of itself? So, for example, do the historical and archaeological references, the geographical references even, fit with the data that is available to us for that period? Does the text make sense of the world as you and I know it? Does it adequately diagnose the human condition? Does the text have that ring of truth, that ring of authenticity? Then there is a second number of kinds of questions, deductive. And this is more looking at the text itself. Does the text we're reading hold together? Is it internally coherent? So if you do step inside that circle, does it actually hold together? Does it contradict itself? Does it make sense as a whole? Now, what's interesting to me is that a vast majority of evangelism in Britain focuses, when we're talking about the Bible, on these questions. But actually, we can't exclusively focus on these questions. We can't just say, listen, believe it because I say so, and step inside it and look at it. We do need to ask these questions, but we need to ask the others as well. I remember a number of years ago, after an evangelistic event, talking to somebody about the Gospels, and we were just talking about the authorship of the Gospels, author's intention, some of the things that I've been talking about here this afternoon. And he was quite a strange guy, as lots of Oxford students are, and he was really quite bright. But when we began to talk about who the authors were, that they were fishermen, one or two of them, and that they had seen these things and were excited about Jesus, he suddenly stopped and said, "Right, that's enough. I want to become a Christian." And I said, that's very strange. I'm really happy about that. I'd love to pray with you. Can I just ask you why?" And he said, "My grandparents were fishermen up in the Isles of Scotland, and I know that fishermen see things as they are. Black is black, white is white. If these authors were fishermen, I know I can trust what they say." Now, that probably has to be the strangest reason I've ever been given for someone wanting to become a Christian. But nonetheless, do you see what's going on here? We're scrutinizing the text and asking questions about the author's intentions. And then lastly on this question, because time is really pressing on, I just want to look very briefly at the idea of reader responsibility. Sometimes the question is articulated, "You don't believe the Bible literally, do you? Eyes popping out, you know, come on, aren't you an intelligent person?" Or perhaps in a slightly more sinister way, fundamentalism is the new enemy in our world. Fundamentalism is based on people taking their holy texts literally. Fundamentalism is therefore dangerous. You are a fundamentalist. It is dangerous to take the Bible literally. I don't know if anyone here has ever been asked a question along that line since September the 11th. But literalism in and of itself is dangerous because of September the 11th. Now, of course, we know that believing in a book in and of itself is neutral. What the book tells you to do is the issue. But let's get back to this question. Do we take it literally? Incredulous, you know, big eyes. What, you mean you really believe it literally? G.K. Chesterton answered this brilliantly, I think, and I always use this when asked this question. And he said this: "The Bible says that Herod is a fox. That does not mean that the Bible writer thought he had pointy ears and a bushy tail. The Bible also says and puts into the mouth of Jesus, 'I am a door.' That does not mean that the Bible writer thought that Jesus was flat, wooden, and swung on hinges. It all depends by what we mean, taking something literally. The reader has a responsibility. The reader and the listener participate in the process of communication. We take the context of the words that we read. We take the cultural context of the text and our own cultural context into consideration.